This is Sunday Magazine, and with me on the phone is Dr. Nash Gabriel from the Gabriel Cancer Center. Dr. Gabriel, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, John.
This morning we're going to talk about end-of-life decisions. You wrote a little post on your blog about end-of-life decisions. It's not an easy topic or, a fun topic to talk about, but it is an important one. And you have some thoughts about getting input from people who maybe have more information and a personal relationship with the patient.
Yeah, it is not a pleasant topic to talk about, but it's a fact of life. Last time I checked, I think most of us will end up dying, right?
One time or another, we certainly will.
And I think knowing that simple fact, I think people need to be prepared, number one, for the what can come at the end of life, what decisions to make. And number two, that preparation and that recommendation or decision that we make, we call this the living will or advance directives. These are the written legal documents that patients write or they do it in advance to tell their loved ones or their family members or their physicians what they will want done if things get real bad.
I think that's what most people think of when we think of end-of-life decisions. We think, let's try to figure out what we want, we'll write it down, and then people will follow what we want.
Yes. The only pitfall to that, of course, is it's very hard to predict the various scenarios that go on in life. So a generic umbrella for those decisions can be tricky, meaning if you put in your living will or in your advance directives, well, if I'm depending on the breathing machine, then I don't want anything else done. Well, there's a problem with that. If you get in a car accident and you get what we call pneumothorax and you end up in a breathing machine, that can well be a temporary thing. And when you recover from that event, you're basically back to normal. So if you go to the literal wording of your advance directive, and if you're incompetent, somebody who is your power of attorney, the durable power of attorney, can potentially simply say, well, you know what, this is what he says, but you really didn't mean that. Now, can we make those advance directives more details? Of course we can, but that will take, it will take writings equivalent to the Affordable Health Act that Obama passed.
Right, thousands of pages. We couldn't really predict any, or we couldn't really come up with what we'd want done in every single situation that might happen to us, I think is what you're
exactly,
saying.
John, health and our human beings, our structure and our physiology is so complex that the scenarios that we can face are so numerous. So that's one aspect. That's the aspect of the literality of it, which we have to be cautious about that simply because somebody said, well, if I depend on a machine, then I don't want anything else done. You have to be careful that doesn't always mean or shouldn't always mean that dependence on a life support for a short period of time is a recipe for almost euthanasia.
Well, when people think of putting that in their living will, they're probably thinking of having some kind of a long-term prognosis that's not so good, not something as immediate as, say, a car accident.
Right. If somebody, exactly. Example, if somebody, let's say, had motor neuron disease, this is a real nasty nerve disease that most of those patients end up being requiring ventilation support. Now, those ones, when you intubate them and you put them in the breathing machine, that's basically a permanent thing. Somebody with very advanced cancer and their lungs are failing because of the cancer advancing. If you put them in a breathing machine, that also, in the opinion of most professionals, would say that's a permanent one because if the cancer is terminal, if the cancer cannot be shrunk, and if the cancer in the lungs is causing the low oxygen, there isn't much you can do to improve the oxygen. On the other hand, if somebody has even advanced cancer and they responded to treatment and they develop pneumonia that will compromise their oxygenation and they require a breathing machine, that's a different story, because that's a transient, temporary thing. So you put them at breathing machine. As soon as you control the pneumonia, if you can, then you're back to baseline, and those patients will potentially be independent of the breathing machine.
Okay, that's an interesting distinction, and that makes sense. If it's the pneumonia, the temporary illness that's causing them to need that machine, then, you know, that's a different situation.
The other thing, John, is I wrote on the blog, and people can access it at www.gabrielcancercenter.com. I wrote the blog because of the experiences I've seen patients have always been my best classes, my best teachers. That's how I learn is from patients. As long as you watch carefully and you analyze carefully, then you come with some, or you deduce some information and some knowledge, and sometimes I put those in the blogs in our website. The patients, when they have these advanced directives, I think we, the healthcare professionals, as well as families, need to know that those decisions made by the patients are not etched in stone. That the patients have the right, which is a human and constitutional right, and they can change their mind anytime they want.
Makes a lot of sense. You know, why should we not be able to change your mind just because we wrote something down in the past?
And from my experience, most people do change their mind. So, you know, you and I are healthy now. We can write that directive. You know what? If I get this cancer or that cancer, I'll just go, you know, let me go. Fact of the matter is, when people get to that scenario, the reality is different then from the reality now. And people have change of heart. I'll give you an example. If you're expecting a grandchild to be born 6 months from now and you get cancer and the doctors tell you that the cancer is, you know, you might not live without treatment, you might not live 6 months, and you will say, you know what, I think I want to see that grandchild.
Yeah.
Compared to somebody who doesn't care about those things or doesn't have such expectations or there isn't much in life. So we have really to tailor things, and we have to make sure that patients exactly know what we know when those patients and families make decisions.
So they have all the information to make that decision.
Right. One other thing I wrote in the blog is the number 6 months has become a magic number in the eyes of the public, the healthcare professionals, even physicians who are not cancer specialists. It's almost like a routine. Anybody who has cancer, they would say to the family, well, you have only 6 months to live. There's really a problem with that. And that's where I wrote the blog, was about who actually should discuss with patients end of life when they are at a critical point in their journey, right? So let's say you have cancer, you go to the emergency room, and these days the politics of the hospitals is you're always admitted under the hospitalist. The hospitalist is an internist who doesn't want to practice in private practice, just want to be employed by the hospital, work every other day, and stuff like that. So this person will come and admit you to the hospital, and often it happens that he will sit or she will sit down and start making all the recommendations and the prognosis and decisions. The family doesn't know usually because, well, he's a doctor, right? Now, you have to be careful with that. Insist that the specialist in the field is not only involved but should be the captain of the team when it comes to these decisions, because the decision has to be informed. The information is best obtained from the experts.
That would seem to make sense to me. If somebody has been undergoing treatment for cancer, say they've been coming to you for cancer treatment, suddenly they're in the hospital in sort of an emergency kind of situation, you would think they would want to consult with their doctor who knows a little bit more about their specific information.
They should. Sometimes they will give a phone call, and I always say, no, I need to see the patient. I need to come and talk to the family because they need to know. Sometimes even your body language, when you talk to the patient's family, can mean a lot to them in terms of where am I leaning, how do I look. And that's become important, John, when if somebody's been fighting cancer for 6, 7, 8 months, I know them in details. They actually know me in details. They know my handicap. They know what I do for fun. So it becomes a very personal relationship. And that bonding creates also trust and creates, how do you call it, not only sympathy. I mean, when you know the patient so well, you tend to be more involved in their decisions, more sympathetic to their situation, and also you know their philosophy.
Right, right. I would think you would tend to kind of get to know how they think and maybe, you know, in a time when it's a very hard decision or very hard decisions to make, you have a little better sense of what they might want to do.
These are patients and families that I will see like sometimes once a week, once every other week. And believe me, when we sit down in the exam room, it's not always talking about their health. It's talking about their kids, talk about the golf game, talk about politics, who will win, who will lose. And these, although are not related to their health care, they actually can be fundamental issues in the rapport between the patient and the physician. And when these patients end up in a hospital, for instance, and all of a sudden a total stranger who has no formal training or experience and who doesn't know them, to sit down and discuss those issues is just beyond me. Now, there's politics everywhere, of course, and the medicine is a commodity, and the hospitals, of course, will want probably more patients to be admitted. The hospital also have hospices. They want patients to be shifted there. That's all okay because it is a business, right? But the individual have the duty, individuals and their families have the duty to be their own advocates.
Absolutely.
And they should be the ones who insist on having the person that they trust the most and who knows them the most and who knows the most about their disease. And that doesn't only apply to cancer. If somebody has congestive heart failure, I think their cardiologist has to be the one who will sit and talk to them. Not the intensivist who just got them for the first time, stuck a breathing tube in their throat and then start talking about this. I don't think that's right. Now, can you change that? Can you change the way we function in the hospitals? It's very hard to change. But when it comes to you and your health, guess what? You have to be in the driver's seat, and you are the one who should decide who to designate to be the final opinion giver, right? And that's where the importance of the trust in your physicians is, because when you trust the physician, then that is exactly the time when you need their opinion the most. Those critical points in your life that can swing you one way or another in your journey in fighting the disease.
Absolutely. So it sounds like really a big takeaway that you would probably have for people is, like you said, to be an advocate for themselves and to ask to talk with that specialist or the doctor that they have more personal interaction with that they feel like knows them the best.
Right. In fact, recently we had one case. This lady has a rare blood cancer. Not rare. It's actually a common blood cancer called multiple myeloma. And she was admitted to the hospital, and the hospital sat down with them and told them, you know what, I talked to your oncologist, and he agrees with me that maybe we should let go. Now, her niece is very affluent young lady, and she said, I'm not sure. She talked to the oncologist, not me, it was somebody else, and he said, well, yeah, they're saying that she's sick and all that. They haven't known him for a long time. So then he said, okay, let's send her home and we'll decide. They go home, and then she called us. We see her for another opinion. And she asked, is this really terminal? I said, you know what, we are all terminal. On average, multiple myeloma patients live for 5 years. This lady has been suffering with her disease for 2 years. That doesn't mean she has only 3 years to live. She might live another 2 months, but she might live another 7 years. Remember,
right.
Geraldine Ferraro, the VP candidate with Mondeo, she had multiple myeloma, and she lived for 12 years with that disease.
Wow.
Advanced cancer. Yeah, these people are living longer and longer. And the diseases and their biology is changing by the day, and that's our job, is to learn those changes. So the point is, the niece said, you know what, my aunt wants to be treated, and I want her to live another 6 months or 1 year. It's not, we just don't feel it's time that she quits, and she doesn't want to quit. What a difference. But she took, she became the driver. She sat in the driver's seat and said, you know what, I don't like what I'm hearing. The expert is not there to explain everything, and the hospitalist is not an expert. He just said, well, okay, you know what, she looks very ill, she's kind of sick, and she has cancer, let go. And I tell you what, John, I want to make a point that really struck me last year with the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare,
mm-hmm.
when part of that Affordable Care Act is that in each county there will be a commission of 3-4 people who will decide who should be treated for a serious illness or who shouldn't be. Sarah Palin, God bless her, she called that the death panels. And trust me, some of that sometimes goes on. Imagine, in the county we'll have 3-4 people who will call my patient. They don't know the patient, but they tell you, based on the numbers, based on the age, and maybe based on your sex, maybe based on your or race, whatever, we don't think you're worth spending the $20,000 in your care. That's basically what it means.
Right. It just comes down to the statistics, basically.
It comes down to statistics, and it shouldn't be that way, especially in a country like the United States. You know, I practice medicine in England, and there in those days in the 80s, if you have kidney failure, if you are above the age of 56, no dialysis. It was a matter of fact, it was accepted. Why? Because the government paid for it, and the government say so. Americans are not like that. Americans, we're more free-spirited people because it is the free-spirited people who decide to migrate here. And that's why I just don't see that this Affordable Care Act will actually fly anywhere, even if it's passed by the Supreme Court, because it strikes the essence of the individual freedom, the right of the people, including patients, to choose what's good for them.
We like to be able to make our own decisions, and you're saying that's a very good thing, to be able to want to do that. Dr. Nash Gabriel from the Gabriel Cancer Center, a very interesting discussion, a very interesting topic, and I think you've helped shed some light on it. If people want to check out your blog post, can you tell us how to get there to your blog again?
They go on www.gabrielcancercenter.com, and it's all one word. The Gabriel is G-A-B-R-A-I-L. And you go Facebook. I think, yes, there is a Facebook icon there on the website. You click on it, and it gives you the summary, and then you click on the summary and gives you the whole details of the article. There are many things also I wrote in that blog that we didn't have time to discuss today, John.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning. Like you said, it's not, not an easy thing to talk about, but definitely issues we need to consider. Dr. Gabriel, thanks for your time.
Thank you, John.